again this verse by Hongzhi. The field of boundless emptiness is what exists from the very beginning. You must purify, cure, grind down, or brush away all the tendencies you have fabricated into apparent habits. Then you can reside in the clear circle of brightness. Utter emptiness has no image. Upright independence does not rely on anything. Just expand and illuminate the original truth, unconcerned by external conditions. Accordingly, we are told to realize that not a single thing exists. In this field, birth and death do not appear. The deep source, transparent down to the bottom, can radiantly shine and can respond unencumbered to each speck of dust without becoming its partner. The subtlety of seeing and hearing transcends mere colors and sounds. The whole affair functions without leaving traces and mirrors without obscurations. Very naturally, mind and dharmas emerge and harmonize. An ancient said that non-mind enacts and fulfills the way of non-mind. Enacting and fulfilling the way of non-mind, finally you can rest. With thought clear, sitting silently, wander into the center of the circle of wonder. This is how you must penetrate and study. So this piece is actually a very helpful guidance to the practice of shikantaza, the practice of just sitting, relying on no contrivance, untouched by human agency. I think we will also be able to see in this piece how it points us to the kind of two sides, the two truths. One is that none of Zen practice, none of our Zazen, none of all of this whole endeavor is about getting anywhere else, into any other kind of mind, into any other kind of life other than this human life, and not just human life kind of generally, but this human life, that human life. Each of our lives is the place to practice. So it is nothing special, nothing unusual, and this is the vast emptiness that exists from the beginning, the circle of wonder, the clear brightness transparent down to the very bottom. Nothing other than this. And also, not nothing. This practice is not nothing. This practice is real and powerful and transformative. But we're not transformed into anything else. So, let's look at a few lines here. The field of boundless emptiness is what exists from the very beginning. This, it's what exists from the very beginning. It's what exists now. And this is what the Heart Sutra reminds us. Emptiness is exactly form. Form is exactly emptiness. The form of emptiness is form. Emptiness has no other form other than the forms we meet in the shape of our lives. And meeting these forms which are also empty, which are not existent anywhere apart from the universe. The universe is one kind of big, all-inclusive whole that includes bodies, plants, minds, stories, reactions, sights, sounds, energy, karma. All of that is just this one bright pearl of the universe. And this is what exists from the very beginning. It's what exists now. It's what we are continually able to find ourselves in. And amid all this, We must purify, cure, grind down, or brush away the tendencies you have fabricated into apparent habits. In a way, there's a whole other Dharma talk other than the one that I'm going to give that I could give on this line. But I just want to call out that part of what this practice does is lets us see our habitual tendencies, the habit energies that have kind of built up through the karmic conditioning of aeons and lifetimes and years and moments built up through our development as a species, built up through the karma that's kind of passed down in the system that is families and societies, and the way we condition our own mind by reacting with aversion when aversion arises, by getting caught up in anger and acting angrily, by continually trying to get away from what we don't want and move towards and get more of what we do want. These are the apparent habits we have fabricated. Utter emptiness has no image. Upright independence does not rely on anything. This line, utter emptiness has no image, is reminiscent of one of my favorite lines in Dogen's Genjo Koan, in which he's saying that Genjo Koan, the practice realization, that is practice enlightenment, that one thing, that compound word that Dogen uses, does not necessarily appear as a view. It isn't that there isn't a image of emptiness that you need to be experiencing. And it isn't, there is, at no point in practice do we ever really get this one unchanging form, right? Because part of what we hear in the Five Remembrances is that there is nothing unchanging. And our practice is to meet this continual change. But it doesn't necessarily form as a view. There isn't anything that you will necessarily at any point have and go, ah, yes. It's just this meeting of your life, meeting of this moment of your life, meeting the difficulty and the tenderness and the heartbreakingness and the sorrow and the insufficiency and the uncompassionateness, meeting all of these things as they arise in our life. That's the only thing, that's the only image that utter emptiness has. Upright independence does not rely on anything. And here is a kind of a really clear reference to Zazen in the Reb Anderson piece we recite sometimes in here. There's the line, sitting upright and unmoving in the midst of delusion. Upright and unmoving in the midst of enlightenment. Just meeting our lives upright. And this upright has nothing to do with our posture. You can meet your life upright, lying on your back, sitting in a chair. Upright independence, meeting this moment as it is, does not rely on anything. It isn't dependent on anything. It isn't dependent on any part of the world being a specific way. Any part of our body, mind, heart being a certain way. And this practice of not relying on anything is the really, really subtle practice of this shikantaza that cannot be done. This shikantaza that isn't in the category of things we can do. And noticing how in our sitting we're continually trying to rely on something. We're trying to rely on concentration, or we're trying to rely on our breath. Now, we do rely on our breath, and we do rely on counting our breath when we're engaged in the practice of following the breath or counting the breath. But after some amount of time with that, we move to the practice of shikantaza, of just sitting, not relying on anything. And the practice, there's another line elsewhere in Hongzhi where he talks about taking one step forward off the cliff's edge. And there's also the koan of stepping forward off the flagpole. But we step off that cliff's edge, and then we're in free fall, and we're in the free fall of not knowing. We're in the free fall of being unable to verify for certain that in this moment we're really doing shikantaza. And since we can't know that for certain, because that becomes a knowing, that becomes an image, then we take the next best thing so often, which is to conclude that we're definitely not doing it, that this is definitely bad and wrong. And to notice that as well, to not rely even on judging ourselves and finding ourselves wanting. Those judgments still arise, and they arise in this field of boundless emptiness. Just expand and illuminate the original truth, unconcerned by external conditions. And again, we don't need the room to be quiet. We don't need our body to not hurt. We don't need our mind to be calm and not continually moving off. We don't need to be smarter or saner or have had a better upbringing or have had more time in our life. Not relying on any external conditions. Also not relying on any internal conditions. And this not relying on any conditions is the real refuge of the Dharma. This is the indestructible refuge. If it relies on conditions, it's conditional. And it will fail. And the time it'll fail is at the worst time possible. Definitionally. And so instead, this practice of meeting this not knowing, of meeting this open-hearted, broken-hearted free fall, is a practice that we can take into any conditions, no matter how painful, no matter how sorrow-filled. No matter how confused and confusing. Still, we don't have to rely even on being unconfused. The deep source, transparent down to the bottom, can radiantly shine and can respond unencumbered to each speck of dust without becoming its partner. And so here we get to a part of this where we see that this practice is not nothing. We can respond. We can respond. We do respond. We must respond to the cries of the world, to our compassionate heart, to the forms that arise and embody this field of boundless emptiness. We can respond unencumbered to each speck of dust without becoming its partner. And part of what we're unencumbered by is our apparent habits that we have fabricated. Part of what we are unencumbered by is, and so this means when we're encumbered by our habits, when we're encumbered by our karma, we're kind of on automatic pilot. We're just acting out of our conditioning. Things arise, we respond to it. Without space for choice. So it seems that's going to go on forever. Right, and so right there is that's just a really good metaphor for the mind of Zazen and the mind of meeting difficulties. And it's often the case that something seems like it's going on forever, that a difficult internal state, like our aversion to some situation, or our self-hatred, or our anxiety, or depression, or fear, is going to go on forever. And there's a place where the practice is to turn towards that, lean into it, and really firmly acknowledge, okay, this may in fact go on forever. And then in really wholeheartedly and turning towards that and acknowledging that this is it, this might be the big one, this might be the thing unlike every other thing that I've ever met that is going to just persist exactly like this till the end of time. And then when we turn towards that, then we see of its own, it does start to change and pass away. It's a little side Dharma talk. So when we're encumbered by our conditioning, there's no space for choice. There is no space to return to our aspirations. Our aspirations to respond with skillfulness, with kindness, with compassion, to respond in the service of all beings. And that is part of our life. Sometimes there is no space. And when there's no choice that we can make, there's no choice that you can make. And then, at some point, whether it's moments, hours, days, years, lifetimes later, then a moment of choice, a moment of spaciousness arises, and we're able to meet each speck of dust, meet each difficult mind state, each mental formation, each suffering being in the world, and respond without defining ourselves by it. Without getting kind of caught within the story of a thought. But sometimes that's what happens. But this practice of sitting upright, relying on no contrivance, not relying on anything, unconcerned by external conditions, this practice that we cannot do, but do, increases our capacity to respond to each speck of dust. And I like how this image, that speck of dust isn't something small and tiny and microscopic, although those are included in the way speck of dust is included. But beings themselves are specks of dust. Mind states are specks of dust. Countries, careers, specks of dust, trees. And to see the arising of our apparent habits, and they're apparent because although the conditioning is there, although they do, these habits do continue to arise, there is within the awareness of that habit the seed of freedom. The subtlety of seeing and hearing transcends mere colors and sounds. The subtlety of sitting upright, relying on nothing, transcends mere conditions of body and mind. But it's not nothing. The whole affair functions without leaving traces, and mirrors without obscuration. The whole affair functions. And this is the perspective. It's not that we do something. It's not that we function the affair. But the whole affair functions. This is it functioning. Your confusion is it functioning. Without leaving traces. And we wish our zazen would leave a trace. We wish it would leave a trace of imperturbable equanimity, you know, that we could then take out into traffic. We wish it would leave a trace of every moment feeling like the good and spacious moments. But the whole affair functions without leaving traces. And mirrors without obscurations. The it of Zen mirrors without obscurations, but sometimes you can't see it. I look so hard, but I can't see it. And that's because we're looking past, we're looking for something other than what we're seeing. This difficulty, this confusion, this I can't see it right now, is exactly the way it is appearing to you. There is no other through it to see. An ancient said that non-mind enacts and fulfills the way of non-mind. Non-mind enacts and fulfills the way of non-mind. And again, this points to it isn't something special, and it isn't something that is done with mind. It's the universe doing it. And we are present to this way of non-mind, enacting through us, with us, in the middle of us, including us, the way of non-mind. And this is there's also the way of non-mind can't be enacted and fulfilled with mind, although it includes mind. And so what would it mean if we sit in presence to our life, in presence to our hearts, Allow that to be the way of non-mind, the way of the universe, enacting and fulfilling the universe. Without falling back to doing or knowing or seeing or realizing. Enacting and fulfilling the way of non-mind, finally you can rest. And this isn't a rest of, that's it, you're done now, you can rest. Or you win, take a nap, or you've worked very hard and now rest. This is a rest that is resting into continual activity. Resting into our lives, not resting from our lives, not taking a break from our lives, but resting in this moment, resting in each moment, whatever it includes, resting in that and responding appropriately, skillfully. But fighting off our lives, fighting off moments. Although sometimes fighting is what arises, and we can rest into that without becoming its partner. With thought clear, wander into the center of the circle of wonder. With thought clear. What is this? This isn't some kind of special quality of thoughts, and it isn't about clearing your mind of thoughts. But when thoughts arise, when mental formations arise, you see them transparently as themselves. Recognizing a thought as a thought, a reaction as a reaction, states as states. To use the metaphor of sight, this is recognizing red as clearly red. And red is not a failed version of blue. You don't have to look at red until you can really see its essential blueness. It's red. And sometimes blue arises. And recognizing blue as blue is thoughts clear, is the transparent quality of emerging, arising dharmas. Wander into the center of the circle of wonder. And of course, the center is everywhere. The center isn't some place we need to get to from here. And the circle of wonder. I like the wandering, and I like the circle of wonder. The circle of wonder is the open and receiving quality with which we can meet our lives, which we can meet the joys and sorrows and the wonder points to this essential quality of practice that is not knowing, that is giving up our mistaken and suffering-causing certainty about the way things should be, or about the way things are, about the way we should be, the way practice should be, the way this moment should be, but instead wandering in with a spirit of of welcoming, with a spirit of curiosity, with a spirit of empirical exploration. This is the wonder with which we can meet even our pain, you know, especially our pain. And and this is how you must penetrate and study. This is all we can do. This is all we can get. And so to meet this wonderingly, curiously, and not depending on internal or external circumstances, this is how you must penetrate and study. So there's that. I wanted to invite folks to react or respond or question or complain.
Circle. Now I can sort of see an empty field. It's kind of like the meadow with all the trees around it, and leaving the trees where you're either hiding from something or too afraid to go out there, but just wandering out in the middle where you're exposed and just seeing what happens.
Yeah.
That's where the field part comes, at least metaphorically.
Yeah. And that seeing what happens, that's the wandering into the circle of wonder. The seeing what happens and seeing what turns out to be here. Yeah. Yeah, I like that image of the empty field actually being this field full of trees. Yeah, and being a field.
I think that the practice can feel that way, in that hiding in the trees is sort of the habits, and just taking a walk out there and, you know, sometimes you wander out there, and sometimes you stick one foot out and go back in. Use a lot of words that are kind of, I guess, they seem sharp as opposed to the way we usually use these words. So like penetrating can sometimes seem like, oh, you're doing a big difficult thing, going in there, penetrating, or you're studying, and we all know how difficult and hard that is to study. people thought, well, I gave up studying, you know, after college. So, you know, the wandering into the empty field is also just penetrating, and practicing for the rest of your life is the same as studying.
you for that.
I'm speaking about our kinhem eye. In our kinhem eye, we've all stood up and walked ourselves and together in wherever we are in that moment, right? Whether I'm brushing up against your heel or kind of lying around because I'm not paying attention. But anyway, I was just... I forgot if I was thinking it was a circle or the field, but I just, yeah, I don't know. I was thinking about the kinhem line.
Mm. Yeah, and circle, field, wonder, wander. There's only ever this. Yeah. Thank you. That's a nice image.
So much of Shikitaza is not something you do. Losing your train of thought here, but the there's a way in which I think we do the searching. And we're searching for some magical place where we're, you know, sort of released from the this and whatnot, and perhaps, you know, it finally dawns on us that that searching, you know, that imaginary place is more. I would bring it just to
right, recognizing the search as just another thing that's arising, we realize that nothing is missing, and that the search is the whole presentation of what it is for us right now. And this is what seeing red as red and not and not as red as looking for blue, but seeing that searching is right here, already in the center of the circle of wonder. And then missing the point entirely of what you just said, you use the great phrase of being liberated from the this and the whatnot. Right. Yeah. That's a really great point. And so confusion and certainty are two sides of the exact same thing. And it actually doesn't matter which one of them is arising. Both of them are forms. Are stories and not truths. Yeah. And so there's a way that we can kind of train ourselves to recognize, oh, right, this is that certainty thing. And see certainty arising as certainty, as opposed to being caught in that certainty and just being present to the arising of an experience of certainty, which may or may not have any relation to anything. And being present just to the experience of confusion when that's what's here. And yeah. And I think that you're also pointing to when we really do approach with this mind of empirical investigation, this mind of wonder, this mind of curiosity, we see that certainty contains confusion, and that confusion contains a kind of certainty. And this part of the certainty that confusion contains is a certainty that we aren't seeing it right now.
Thank you. My particular twist on that is laid out before me on the return from Sasheen. I told you about this before, everyone else, and maybe some of you had the same experience. Anyway, it was a 3-day Sasheen, and then I had to go directly from there to work to set up some things for the coming week. So, you know, I was feeling kind of sorry for myself because of that, but I was going to plug on it and do it, and like, a half mile from the temple heading into Worcester, I hit the St. Patrick's Day parade. Mm-hmm. And the two routes that I knew to get back to Boston were both blocked. No detour signs, you know, just you can't go. I drove around, and followed other cars and somehow ended right back up in that same spot a half hour later. It's like, I can't get out of Worcester. Parade's still going on. Yeah. And there was a policeman there, I don't know, not really directing traffic, just standing around. So I asked him, you know, can you give me a tip how I could get back to Boston? And he said, well, you go this way, you go that way. Because none of those roads had signs on them. But somehow I did find my way. But so by this time, I'm seething, you know, just like, I can't believe it. I can't get out of Worcester of all the stupid things to put the parade down the center. And you know, I'm realizing there's a certain clarity somewhere that comes up that this is exactly what I've been practicing for, you know? For 3 days sitting so that I could see these things arising and not necessarily just, you know, immediately react. And so the twist on it is that I was so sure that this was an exception. You know, anytime these things come up, they're always the exception. They don't not, because somehow, you know, like Buddha did not take into account the possibility of St. Patrick's Day.
Right.
Three
cars.
Yeah, it doesn't count. You get a free pass on that one. You're right to be angry. Yeah. So it's recognizing that, you know, all that is all it. Yeah.
Mm. Right. And yeah, we so badly want something to be the exception, right? And this is the practice. This is the liberating value of meeting everything that arises in our zazen, in our shikantaza, as just in the one category of things that arise. And this is and meeting it all in the category of things that arise, as opposed to dividing it into the things that should arise and the things that shouldn't arise, the things that are good and the things that are a problem. But meeting it all is exactly practice in being able to meet the St. Patrick's Day parade as and being able to meet our seething rage, our blinding, overcoming, overpowering, mind-crushing rage.
Wasn't that bad.
And she was beating up the cop. She like kicked him and he was down and the ambulance came. It was a mess.
I'm supposed to tell that part.
Who is on the council to decide next year's machine? The big question.
similar to, completely relating to this whole, I'm in the aversion, I'm eating at home, I'm feeling the rage thing. I find myself in a similar situation the other day with a relationship, with a relative. And I was like completely on autopilot in anger, but there was part of me, the part that sits, that recognized that that was just a reaction. But even in recognizing it, I couldn't pull out of that, and I found that really frustrating. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know where I got stuck with that.
Yeah, that's exactly where I was. Yep, and find myself there again and again. And that's also part, for me, part of the practice to not push that away. You know, not say, oh, you know, everything else is okay. It's all right to be frustrated about the St. Patrick's Day parade, but it's not okay to get angry, you know, because I'm a Zen student and I should be beyond that or something. So it's also, when you're angry, you're angry. And then at some point, you're not anymore. You can begin again.
I guess the twist on it for me is when you're dealing with a person with whom you want to be compassionate, and you can't,
I think it's clear.
I don't think there's a guarantee that it's going to be, you know, you're going to, that I'm going to react in some perfect way and skillful way every time. But there's that whole, that triangle that Josh has talked about of making the mistake, atoning, resetting your aspirations, you know, and taking steps forward again until the next mistake. I mean, that is the path, the straight path is not really straight. So
you just get used to doing the triangle.
Right, and
I don't know if you get used to it, but
well, and because we want it to leave the traces. We want when we set our aspiration to just keep going straight on till morning, right? But then we find ourselves falling short of our aspirations again, and then we have to acknowledge that and take responsibility and do what we can when we can. So part of that is and not before we can. So part of what's going on is wanting to be able to have some kind of reaction, other reaction, before it's possible for you to have that other kind of reaction. So sometimes it isn't possible and we want it to happen concurrently with the arising of the anger or the difficulty in the circumstance, but sometimes it doesn't. And so sometimes then what we have to do is take a walk for an hour, or we have to go away for a week until at some point we're able to say, yeah, so I'm sorry about that thing on Tuesday. I really got caught up in that, and that isn't what I want to stand behind, but instead what is in line with my intention, my aspiration, is this. And do that when you can, not before you can. And you're also pointing to something that is a really important and excellent stage of practice, which is there's a kind of visual metaphor describing the practice through stages, which has its problems, but called the ox herding pictures, right? Which show a different stage of a farmer losing his ox and looking for it and bringing it home, and the fifth one is seeing the ox and have it holding on to its thing, and the ox resisting with all its might, like this, right? And that's the experience that you're having, you know, and that's the experience of seeing your habit patterns and seeing all of your reactivity and for all the world being unable to do anything about it, right? But that's always been going on. That reactivity has always been going on. But how marvelous that now you're noticing it. And then we want to be at the other stage where we're able to, or the stage we're going to be at in an hour or in 2 weeks, where we can notice it and then do something different. But we're not at that stage. We're just at the stage of noticing it and noticing being caught by it.
So that stage does exist, though?
Yeah. Well, I mean, what would it mean if I said no to that, right? I mean, it exists for you. That's what you saw. That's your experience. You don't, and so to... Oh, well, right, and so the problem of linear stages is that it makes it seem like you wrap up with stage five and then move on to stage six, and but really it's more like a spiral, and we're continually going, coming back past the same landmarks, but it isn't just a circle. So each time we come by, it's a little bit different, but also the same. But even and so, but that stage six or whatever that we're talking about isn't something that's going to happen to you in 10 more years of practice. It's what is arising for you now when you are seeing that reactivity and recognizing and having some space to meet that reaction without having been caught up in becoming its partner. Great question, thank you.
Can I, and I also, you just are nailing it, like this is where the difficulty is. But also that making a mistake in the relationship and then atoning and maybe coming back in 2 weeks and saying, gee, I was really wrong about that, is very liberating for the other person, for them to, it gives them the opportunity to do the same thing. Say, oh yeah, you know what, I was falling into that same routine that I always do. And not being the perfect person, not immediately getting it right, and perfect people are just irritating, So it's not such a bad thing to make a mistake and then atone for it and move forward. It's, you take everyone with you.
Yeah, and this is how we save all beings with our little teeny miserable inadequate reactive practice.
I was just going to say that I like the idea that the kind of line we talked about with queer thoughts, you can rest something to that effect.
Mm-hmm.
And when Kate was talking about the anger and frustration at the parade, it made me wonder if, once Kate realized kind of what was going on and she kind of accepted where she was, is that kind of maybe the place of rest that he's referring to? I guess it's just a question. Do you think that's it or part of it?
Oh, you're asking me?
Either, whoever wants to grab that.
I can't say I found the place of rest that day. So maybe it's now, but, or just isn't. But I'm sure you've had experiences where, for example, for me, maybe Sue will relate to this. I was told ahead of time that I was going to be the timekeeper. To me, that's the worst job there is in the sesshin. It's just so demanding. You don't get as much sleep as anyone else. You don't get to hang out at the snack table during the, the kinhin. I was just dreading it and sort of like, oh, I don't want to do this. And then there was this resting into it. Okay, it's going to be what it is. Here I go. So I'm sure that you've had those kind of experiences too. That's how I see resting in it. No longer trying to make it something else or fighting it off, but just this is what there is. Set.
And that moment of, this is that thing I'm practicing for, that also is a moment of rest. Maybe it's only a microsecond before it, gets tracelessly wiped away. But that also is the rest. Resting into it is only something that arises individual microsecond by individual microsecond. And resting into this moment does nothing about the next moment. You've got to meet that moment too and rest. Yeah, some imaginary rest, yeah. Right, yeah, and just coming back, that peeling back that one layer, is all it is. So you don't have to not struggle. You just have to not struggle against struggling. Or if you're struggling against struggling, you don't have to struggle against struggling against struggling. And instead, you can just and it doesn't matter which of the and they're actually all exactly the same. And they all get cut through by just coming back that one level. Did you have something more you were going to say, Keith?
I might have, but it's gone.
All right, everybody. Thank you so much. Thank you for your wholehearted wandering in wonder with us.